Right. Okay. So second talk. We've been trying this year and last year to get more members of Radical History Group to do talks. And if you do get involved with the group, which I hope some of you might do in the future, then we do encourage members of the group to do talks. So Dan's kindly doing his first talk for Bristol Radical History Group. But he's a bit of a professional, really. So so I don't think he'll have problems speaking. Just a couple of things, really. First of all, we've produced three pamphlets this year. We're trying to produce a series of Bristol Radical History Group pamphlets. So we've got one on Thomas Clarkson, which was written by Mark Steeds, who spoke about Thomas Clarkson several times in the Seven Stars pub and also at some of our events. There's also one about smuggling, which was written by Kev Davis, who's on the door at the moment. He did a talk last year. And the third one's by Dan, which I think he wrote some time ago.
Which is the talk today.
So, you know, please, if you get a chance, get hold of the pamphlet and see what you think. We're really interested in comments about them as well. There was one slight problem with Dan's pamphlet when we got it. That's excellent, really informative. And I heard yesterday of somebody who came here that it's kind of popular in the United States as well. There's a lot of work going on around corporations, their legal status. But when we looked at the pamphlet, we thought, well, there's not many jokes in it. So I hope you've got a few jokes today. So we stuck a comic on the back about corporations. So if you go and have a look over there, you can see that. Anyway, Dan's talk.
Okay, thanks. Okay, I'm talking very briefly about the history of corporations, how they started, how they came about. Before we understand what corporations are and where they fit in, you have to understand that in English law, and in fact most countries' law, there's recognition only of two entities, the state and people. The state was originally seen as the king, the queen, sometimes called the crown. The state nowadays has expanded beyond what it once was. The state includes the governments, the ministries, the Ministry of Defence, the armed forces, bodies which we now refer to as being emanations of the state, hospital trusts, councils, anything which is part of the state is one body in the eyes of the law. And the second is people. There is no other entity recognised in law. If I'm a person, I'm carrying on trade, I'm still just a person. If I decide to carry on trade and I want to set up as a mechanic and I call myself Ace Motors, there is no such thing as Ace Motors. The law won't recognise Ace Motors. It is still just me. If I form a partnership with two or three other people and we get together and we start a business or any activity that might be, the courts don't recognise the partnership or the name of the partnership as a distinct entity. It's still just people. And this is true of any association, any partnership. You hear about law firms being partnerships, accountancy firms being partnerships. The name is just there to identify the collective. It has no status in law whatsoever. The law will not say, well, that's a partnership. What it will say is, you say it's a partnership. That means it's a group of individual people. And as far as the law is concerned, it's the individual people that have status before the law, not the partnership. This will be true of clubs, of cooperatives, of all these phrases and terms we hear, which are used to describe groups of people working together in business or otherwise. They don't have any recognitions at all before the courts and before the law. There's just the state and there's people. Disputes between states is international law. Disputes between people is civil law. Disputes between state and people is criminal law or human rights law, whatever it might be. So where do corporations fit into this? Well, in the Norman times, after 1066, the Normans brought to England land registration and the idea that every land should have the name of an entity which owns it. And this had to be either the king, the crown, or the individual. And throughout early Norman times, there was development of this legal concept, particularly land law and boundary rights and everything else that went with it. And into this came concepts such as monasteries. What do you do with monasteries? You could put them down as being owned as the abbot, owned by the abbot, and people who worked for the monastery could work for the abbot. But what happened when the abbot died? Did you need a transfer of all the land owned by the monastery? Did you need new contracts for everyone who worked for the monastery? So the Normans also brought across the concept of incorporation from the Latin word of corpus, meaning body, that monasteries could incorporate, and then the law would treat the monastery as if it was a person. And this is termed in law a legal fiction. We pretend that a monastery is a real person. And for about 500 years, The concept of incorporation existed, but only for not-for-profit bodies. Monasteries, hospitals, schools, later municipal councils, bodies that existed for long periods of time and which naturally served the public good. The courts would, they could go to the government, they could be to the crown, be granted crown charters of incorporation, and from then on, once they were incorporated, they would be treated by the law as if they were a real person, with the rights of a real person, which is to own lands, to enter into contracts, to be sued, to sue other people, to have a status in society which otherwise they wouldn't have. It would have to be in the name of the individuals. At this time, businesses were not operated as corporations. It was against the law for businesses to incorporate. All businesses were either individuals trading in their own name or partnerships, groups of people trading again as individuals. They remained at all times the personal responsibility for carrying out a business. There was no separation between the person and the business. People remained entirely responsible for the actions of their business. Towards the end of the 1500s, new types of bodies became incorporated. The concept was extended. It still remains not-for-profit, but the idea was extended, and you had the establishment of guilds, watchmakers' guilds, printers' guilds. And the idea of these guilds is that they would go to the crown and say, well, grant us a charter of incorporation. We will be the watchmakers' guild. If anyone wants to be a watchmaker, they have to join our guild, and we can make sure that they are suitably trained and qualified, and we will regulate the trade. Now, clearly, a lot of what the guild did was to stop entry to the trade of outsiders, and it meant that they could restrict the number of people practicing in the area. But nevertheless, these remained not-for-profit entities. The guilds didn't take part in business. The guild just oversaw the business. The merchant venturers was similarly such a type of guild. It had the monopoly on trade through Bristol Docks. It itself didn't trade, but if you wanted to trade through Bristol Docks, you had to join the merchant venturers. In 1600, the East India Company was formed, and the East India Company was granted a royal charter with a monopoly on trade to India. If you wanted to trade to India, you had to join the East India Company, and the East India Company then regulated the trade to and from India. Again, a not-for-profit corporation. Trading to India was risky. There was long distances to cover, but there was great wealth to be gained. And what happens over the course of the early 1600s is the various different members of the East India Company join together in larger and larger partnerships, so they're gradually sharing the risks of their businesses to and from India. They remained individuals. The East India Company was stayed out of it. It regulated the trade. But this amalgamation of all the members' businesses continued until eventually there was only one business partnership operating within the East India Company. All the members of the East India Company had all amalgamated their stock into a single business partnership. And then sometime around 1620, 1630, no one really seems to be sure, the partners in the businesses sold their stock to the East India Company itself and in return received shares in the East India Company. And the East India Company actually carried out the trade to India itself. This was unlawful, this was illegal, this was without public debate. But the East India Company became the first commercial corporation, the first time in history where the corporate form was used for business. And you can see this has enormous advantages. The East India Company could borrow money, and the members of the company wouldn't be at risk because they were no longer the person taking the risk. The person that was taking the risk was the East India Company, because in the eyes of the law, the East India Company was a person. If the East India Company killed a load of people, the members of the company were not responsible, the shareholders weren't responsible, because they hadn't killed anyone. The East India Company had killed people. Now, it could be sued for what it had done, but it created a separation between the people who were making the money out of the business and the responsibility for their actions. And the courts termed this the corporate veil. The courts would draw a veil between the actions of the company and the actions of its members, because they accepted the fiction that the company was a person. And since it was a person, other people couldn't be held responsible for its actions in the same way as parents can't be held responsible for the actions of an adult child. They're separate people. The East India Company became very profitable because it could take risks that businesses beforehand could not take because people's houses were no longer riding on it. They couldn't be pursued, and so risks could be taken that couldn't be taken beforehand, and it made a huge amount of money with a monopoly on the whole of India. And other corporations start to do the same, many of them doing so unlawfully, using their state charters as trade associations, such as the Hudson Bay Company and the Levant Company, similarly started to trade illegally as corporations. Other corporations actually went to the Crown and said, well, we want to trade as a commercial corporation, grant us a charter. And the Crown started to grant charters to companies expressly to trade as corporations, but again, there'd been no debate on this, no discussion in parliaments. It just simply started to happen. By the early 1700s, two specific problems had occurred. One is that companies such as the East India Company had become so hugely powerful that they'd actually taken over territories. The East India Company had its own army, it had conquered India, and it was ruling India. It had achieved the power of a state. The second problem was problems of fraud. This is most shown through the South Sea Company. It was granted a royal charter with a monopoly to trade from ports in various ports in South America. The problem was that these ports were then under Spanish control, and the corporation sold shares upon the basis that when the English military liberated these ports and claimed them for England, then there would be a huge amount of trade going through these ports and a lot of profit to be made. And these shares were traded on a speculative basis, people speculating on how much it would be worth when this battle took place and when the British took control of these ports. But the war with Spain wasn't going that well. It diverted away from South America, and it soon became clear that these ports were never going to be gained under British rule, and the company was never going to make any profits, and the founders of the corporation fled the country. The share prices collapsed overnight, and this triggered a collapse in many of these corporations when people realised that many of these corporations were speculative. There was no basis for them. It wasn't like the East India Company where it was an existing trade that became corporatised. They had set themselves up specifically with these trade monopolies given by the Crown, and there was nothing into them. So a whole wave of corporations collapsed, and a lot of people lost a lot of money. So in 1720, the government brought in an act, it's known as the Bubble Act, and this act did a number of things. First of all, it nationalised the East India Company, the Levant Company, the Hudson Bay Company, many of these huge corporations, and took their territories under British rule, effectively creating much of the British Empire. Because that's why India became part of the British Empire, because the government nationalised the East India Company. Secondly, the Act brought into place two new rules. The first of these was that a corporation, tending to the common grievance, prejudice and inconvenience of His Majesty's subjects, would be illegal and void. This gave people the right to declare corporate actions unlawful and illegal if they tended to the common grievance of the people of the country. The third thing the Act did was it banned speculative buying and selling of shares. It became illegal to own shares in a company unless you were actively participating in running that company. It tied together, once again, the idea of running a business and being responsible for a business. And these laws remained in place for over 100 years, laws which are so aggressive and pro people that we just can't imagine such laws today. The idea that you can declare the actions of a company to be illegal because they cause harm to people. And these laws existed for 100 years. And during this period, between 1720 and 1825, things carried on, but without the Chartered Corporation. And instead, what the government introduced was a new concept. And this was a statutory corporation. Corporations created by the government, but for very narrow, specific, regulated purposes. And these were created for the building of canals and waterworks and for the building of railways. The idea being that these projects were so big and involved such engineering expense that individuals could not be expected to put up money and remain personally responsible, have their houses and land at risk if these projects went bad and wrong. So in very specific circumstances, the governments would either outwardly create these companies, or on the basis of representation from people with plans, would create companies with specific purposes to build specific railways or specific canal works. And this was a very successful project. It continued for a long period of time. In 1776, Adam Smith said that this concept of incorporation was justified for banking, insurance, canal building and waterworks, but for nothing else. And in The Wealth of Nations, he said the concept of the commercial corporation being any wider than this will be contrary to the public interest, because he saw it as being hugely important that people remain directly responsible for their business actions, just as they remained in their ordinary life. In 1825, there was an enormous change to this 100-year regime of controlled corporate activity, controlled corporate formation, and protection from harmful corporate activity. And this took place under the actions of two particular politicians, Huskisson and then Gladstone, both Liverpool-born and bred, in a city that was actively trading around the world at the time. And they sponsored the development of laissez-faire capitalism, as they called it, liberal capitalism. And they used the language of rights. They recognised the idea that a corporation was a person before the law, and sponsored the idea that these people should be free. These people should have freedom to trade. And they spoke in Parliament about the need to give corporate people freedom and the need for it to be unrestrained from the actions of governments. And between 1825 and 1856, they introduced three acts which revolutionised the way that business was carried out in this country. In 1825, they abolished the Bubble Act. From then on, it was no longer illegal to carry out business activities to the common grievance. It became legal to do so, because you couldn't interfere with the business activities of people anymore. In 1844, they introduced the Joint Stock Companies Act, and this introduced the first time the modern concept of the corporation, the registered corporation. You didn't have to appeal to the Crown or the government. You'd simply go to a civil servant and say, I want to register this corporation as my corporation. And once you'd done that, you could carry out your business in the name of the corporation. So you yourself would no longer be the person who is carrying out the business. The corporation, this fictional legal person, this body that the courts and the state would recognise as being a person, would be the person carrying out the trade. You wouldn't be doing so anymore. In 1855, a further act was introduced, the Limited Liability Act, and from this point onwards, it was made clear that if the corporation went down and had debts, the people running the corporation could not be pursued for those debts. Although beforehand people had realised this may be the implications of having a corporation that was a person. If the corporation was the person, then how could you pursue anyone else? This made it law that if the corporation went down, went bankrupt, the people, the shareholders, could not be responsible for the debts of this corporation. And there was debate in Parliament about this, because people said, well, it was only 100 years ago that corporations were doing enormous harm to this society. Why has this changed around? And there was much debate about how this was the advantages of Britain was the freedom of trade. But also there was a couple of instances where there was debate saying that that this would benefit individual people. First off, the idea was that the poor would be able to invest in these corporations for the first time. And in any event, these corporations would have the word limited after their name, limited liability. So anyone dealing with these corporations would realise that they had limited responsibility to those who were dealing with them. Of course, what wasn't understood at the time is that it would only be a matter of years before all business activity was pretty much carried out through the corporate form. But there was also no debate of the conflict of this created. Whilst it's true that if people invest in a company, they couldn't be pursued for the debts, there was no recognition of what this meant for the balance. If a company goes bankrupt, not being able to pay employees' wages, there's a choice between who gets paid. Can the employees go after the shareholders to be paid, or shall the shareholders be protected from the employees? And the debates on the impact on the middle and working classes from the formation of the corporations only looked at the protection of the middle and working classes as shareholders. It never envisaged, well, what happens to these workers? they will not be paid. There was never any consideration of the consequence of that. Similarly, if a bank or some other savings company went bankrupt, there was no consideration of the balance that the savers' money would be lost. The shareholders would be protected, but the savers' money would be entirely lost. They would have no one to pursue. From 1855 onwards, then, there was no state control of corporate behaviour. The state had absolved itself of responsibility for looking after corporations. And so the duty passed to the courts. But the court's duty was only very narrow. The court's role was only very narrow. All corporations, when they registered, had to have what's called an objects clause. They had to say what it was that they were doing, what it was they were incorporating to do. And people had the right to challenge through the courts if they felt the corporation was acting outside this activity. So, for instance, if you had a corporation and it was to build a railway between Norwich and Ipswich and operate that railway, you couldn't then start buying up other railways and building other railways and expanding your role as a corporation. Your object was to run that railway between Ipswich and Norwich. And the courts recognised this, and throughout the 1800s, the courts frequently and repeatedly, and I give some examples in the pamphlet, struck down corporate actions where corporations tried to expand their business base, tried to buy out rivals or compete with rivals or take on a wider role. And a battle developed with corporations using two tactics to get around this. The first was that when they formed themselves, they would make their objects clauses wider and wider and wider, eventually saying that the object of this company is to carry out any area of trade whatsoever. And secondly, each time these were challenged in the courts, they would fight, and case after case after case, throughout the 1800s through the early 1900s, there was hundreds of cases where corporate activity was challenged in the courts, where people tried to hold corporations' expansion back. Admittedly, much of this legal activity was right by smaller corporations trying to prevent larger corporations taking over their sphere of business. This was not activity by ordinary people. But some of it was by non-corporate business interests trying to hold back the development of corporations. This was brought to an end in two blows. Firstly, in 1966, the Court of Appeal in this country finally recognised that it was valid to have an objects clause which said this corporation has the right to do anything, any area of trade whatsoever. And you will no longer be able to challenge a corporate activity on the basis that it's not established to do that sort of activity. And then finally, in 1989, the Companies Act 1989 made it unlawful for anyone outside the corporation to challenge corporate activity at all. From 1989 onwards, the only people who can challenge the corporation's actions is the directors of the corporation themselves. Even shareholders aren't allowed to say this corporation is acting ultra vires. I think if you have over 20% of the shares in the company, you can claim to be a shadow director, and then under the Companies Act, you can challenge the actions of the corporation. But other than that, the only people who can challenge it is the corporation itself. So, looking back, and I've rattled through this in fairly quick time, looking back, you've got to see the scale of the development that's taken place. We started out in 1600 with anyone carrying out a business having to carry it out in their own name and being entirely responsible for their own actions. We then developed through the course of the 1600s the idea that we could create fictitious people to carry out business, fictitious people who could not just carry out the business, but take full responsibility for the carrying out of that business. Third, we abolished laws which forbade corporations from acting to their common grievance, abolished laws which would allow people to challenge corporate activity on the grounds that it was causing harm to the public. Fifth, we transferred from the government to the courts, and then from the courts to the directors themselves, the responsibility for controlling corporations. It started off, it was the government that said what could and could not be carried out through corporate activity. Then it was transferred to the courts, who could say what corporations could and could not do. Now the companies themselves decide what they can and what they cannot do. And there are certain examples where we see the significance of this. We see it particularly in the modern world through the creation of subsidiary corporations. Because what a subsidiary corporation is, a corporation owned by another corporation. It's a corporation without shareholders, without any real people in any control. In 1967, the Torrey Canyon ran aground in the English Channel off the Isles of Scilly and spilt huge oil spill across the whole area. And the governments ran the cleanup operation, the Coast Guards, millions of pounds spent on the cleanup operation. And once the cleanup operation was over, the government approached the ship company and the company that owned the oil on the ship and said, well, we want to claim back now the money that was spent on the cleanup because it was your ship and your oil. What they discovered is that the people operating the ship had leased the ship for that journey only and had no assets. The company owned the lease for this ship for this one journey only, this one voyage charter, and that was the only thing on the company's books. The company that owned the oil had bought the oil as it had gone onto the ship and had an agreement to sell the oil when it got to its destination. So the only thing that company owns was the oil on the ship, which was now on the sea. So when the government tried to recover its costs from both these corporations, it realised that they have nothing in them. They, not only were they fictional people, they were completely made of paper. And when the government said, well, we want to go down the line to see who is actually responsible, because clearly corporations owning nothing can't really be running the oil industry, the court said, well, no, corporate veil. The court recognised that these are real people, and therefore you cannot go beyond these people to see who is responsible. You can't look beyond it. In any event, the shipping companies are mostly registered in Liberia, a shipping registry that doesn't actually exist in Liberia. It exists in South Dakota and is run by an American businessman who's bought the right to run the Liberian registry off the Liberian government. And you can register your ships there, and it's a secret register. You're not actually allowed to find out who owns the ships. Similarly, the shipping companies will be registered in offshore locations in companies' registers where you're not allowed to find out who the shareholders are. So over a relatively short period of time, we as people have lost all control over business activity. Similarly, in the sphere of human rights, it's unbelievable what's happened. We've learned through Peter Linebaugh, the whole point of human rights is to put the government under law. The government, not the people. And we talked at the outset, the law only recognises two types of people. There is the state and there is people. The state includes the ministry, the armed forces, the hospital trusts, all the emanations of the state. Everyone else is people. The people have protection of human rights law. The state is subject to human rights law. Corporations are people. Corporations can claim the protection of human rights law and do so. If you look at the books of the European Court of Human Rights, you'll see a very significant amount of litigation is brought by corporations asserting their human rights to transfer their goods across borders without restriction. Because Protocol 1, Article 1 of the European Human Rights Convention is the right to free use of your possessions. And corporations use this right and assert this right repeatedly to prevent government restriction on their free use of their possessions. And there's nothing we can do about this, because they are people before the eyes of the law. That's pretty much all I've got to say on corporations. I've rattled through it pretty quickly. The pamphlet goes through it in much more detail, particularly the legal changes and the acts and what the courts tried to do at the various points in time. But does anyone have any questions about corporate? Yep.
If corporation is legally a person, what prevents that person being taken to court and sentenced, not here, but in other countries, sentenced to either the death sentence or life in prison?
Yeah.
If they are carrying out murder, manslaughter, or any other hideous crimes against people, what prevents them as a person being held accountable?
This is one of the major debates that took place, particularly in the 90s, about how corporate activity could be restrained. And there's a body in London called the Centre for Corporate Accountability. And this is one of their key issues, the use of criminal law against corporations. Problem is, although it's a person, it has no body. It can't be physically restrained or imprisoned like a real person can. in the States, one that's the Program on Corporation Law and Democracy is key on this idea of having a death penalty for corporations, about being able to kill the corporation. The problem is, again, it's a paper body. It can simply transfer its assets to another body.
Surely, if you've done some hideous crime, you can have your assets.
Can be asset stripped. And but surely, again, a name is of huge value to a corporation. Sure. What prevents them from asset stripping a corporation?
There's two responses to that. First is, if you are carrying out corporate activity that is risky, you will carry it out through a subsidiary. If you look at British Petroleum, there are about 600 or 700 British Petroleum corporations registered in this country alone. Around the world, thousands. If you're carrying out a risky activity, you carry it out through a subsidiary with no assets. The only assets that subsidiary will own is the responsibility for the risky activity. Further, once you have gone on in time and there is potential liabilities for past activities, you can similarly sell the past activities to a corporation. I worked on cases against Monsanto. They have a factory in Ceffinmaer in North Wales, which frequently leaked hydrogen sulfide gas and poisoned the local population. And when we came eventually to get around to litigating against them, it took us a year, 2 years to get it together, to issue the court proceedings, we found that the corporation that ran the plant at the time had, although that still existed, it had sold the plant on to a new corporation, but retains for itself all the responsibilities for the past activities for the corporation. So the corporation that had leaked the gas in 1998 was still there. So yeah, we were that corporation, we were that person, we leaked the gas in 1998. You sue us, but you can't strip us of the factory because we don't own it anymore. We sold it to this new corporation, and they own the factory now, but we haven't sold them the responsibility for the past activities. What they also did was they changed the name. That the company which used to be called Monsanto and ran the factory changed its name to Global Strike, which is just the name of the company they bought off a book. And then the company that they sold the factory to became Monsanto. So they said, you can't even put Monsanto on the claim form, on the writ, which we did. We said Global Strike, formerly known as Monsanto PLC. But again, it's impossible to pin them down because, as people, they can kill themselves, they can divest themselves of all their assets. A particularly common one is, we used to call it the triangle structure, and all the asbestos companies do this, where companies that Turner & Newell and Cake PLC that traded asbestos throughout the last century realised that they were paying out for people who were developing asbestos-related illnesses and dying 30, 50, 60 years later. So what they did was that the company that owns the business sold all the current assets in the business to another company, and this company itself loans the money to buy the assets off a third company. So this company had nothing to buy it with, but held all the assets, and this company was left owning only one thing: the past liabilities of the corporation. It didn't own the current stock and trade of the business. It didn't own the goodwill of the business. It didn't own the patents of the business. It didn't own the machinery of the business. The only thing that it kept was the past responsibilities. They said, yeah, we ran this company between 1901 and 1989. Anything that this corporate person, did is our responsibility. And then you can leave that corporation on the books. You can leave it alive. And at Corporate House, there are thousands and thousands of corporations which are called dormant. They're no longer trading, but they're alive, these zombie corporations, holding nothing but the responsibilities for past actions. When nuclear fuels are transferred around this country by rail, you can be guaranteed that when the nuclear fuel goes on that train, it is sold to a company with no assets, and that company holds the responsibility for that journey and then sells the fuel off to its destination. And this is standard activity for all corporate behaviour.
There was a couple before that, sorry.
I'd just like to ask about how the nationalisation of the East India Company was handled. Was there much resentment and reaction from the shareholders at the time?
They were compensated hugely.
I expect. I expect so. I don't really know. There's a book actually on the stands, which I haven't written, but it's about the history of the East India Corporation, which goes in much, much more depth to its creation, how it went. I'm not sure they deal with the corporate angle of it. I'm not sure they distinguish between how it went from being a trade association to being a corporation. I'm not sure they picked up on that. But it does deal with what happens at the end of its nationalisation. But I expect they were hugely compensated.
Yeah.
A couple of questions. First, I'm still a bit unclear about, because we use the word corporation nowadays generally, to sort of people who don't think of like huge companies.
Yeah.
But we're saying that any company or any limited company is in effect a corporation.
Yeah. Anything with limited or PLC is public limited company, which is just a different type of regulation. Anything with limited after its name is a corporation and is recognised by the courts as being a real person with a person's rights and responsibilities.
So when we're talking about corporations, what we really should be distinguishing is, that's when we talk about multinational corporations, that's when we're talking about the really big ones, but actually small companies,
yeah,
corporations.
The key is the divestment of personal responsibility for your actions. You can create a fictitious person, so I'm going into trade, I'm going to create a fictitious person, and I'm going to trade through this fictitious person. So that if anything goes wrong, it's the imaginary person who's responsible, and they can't go after me. Now, if you're running a newspaper shop on a high street, and you're the sole director and you're the sole shareholder of the corporation, that separation is somewhat illusory, because if you're doing something really quite bad, then they're going to go after you because you're small scale, and they can say, well, you are the sole director and we've got director's laws we can use against you. You are the sole shareholder. But once you get up in size and scale, then that becomes more difficult. Once you're dealing with shares that can be traded and speculated from. And we've got this odd situation that people buy and sell shares in arms companies. Arms that are sold to countries illegally and used to kill people. People buy shares in tobacco companies knowing that these companies are going off into developing nations and aggressively marketing cigarettes while not telling people about the health risks and killing people. We buy shares in mining companies which we know are desecrating large areas of lands, destroying livelihoods, destroying huge areas of common land. And we can do this without any responsibility for our actions because we are not doing it. The fictitious person is doing it. It's that separation which is so important. And it's that separation that in 1720, when they brought in the Bubble Act, they recognised was the problem. And that's why they outlawed speculative buying and selling of shares. That's why they outlawed harmful conduct. And said, look, you can be a corporation, but only if you are actually running the business. So you're in the situation of the newspaper shop, where you can say, well, okay, you say it's a fictitious person, but we know it's really you. You can't really hide. I mean, you can to some extent. You can hide certainly from the debts. And you can see some logic to that, allowing people to hide from low-scale debts. What you can't hide from is
pouring chemicals down the drain, because they know it's you, because there's no one else there.
So that brings me on to the second question I had, actually, which was when in the initial period when corporations, you could go after a corporation for doing something harmful to the, you know, the common good or whatever. When you could do that,
yeah.
What sort of things were people bringing up to, I mean, obviously really threatening, otherwise they wouldn't have stopped that.
I can only find one prosecution under the Bubble Act. What happened instead is that charters just were not given out to corporations. People traded as individuals and as partners. They didn't trade under the fictitious person of a corporation. It simply didn't happen. The only corporate activity that was going on was the state-registered corporations, the canal works and the railways. And these, you know, we think of these. An example nowadays would be the Docklands Corporation or the Channel Tunnel Corporation. These corporations set up. The Olympics Committee is another one, set up for a very narrow, specific, almost public quasi-public purpose. That was the only corporate activity that was really taking place. The rest of corporate activity, this laissez-faire capitalism that had existed in the 1600s and early 1700s, simply stopped, and stopped for the best part of 100 years, and only started up again with Gladstone's reforms from the 1820s onwards. Just didn't happen. Trade continued, but there was quite a large recession in the country at the same time, and that's what Gladstone was rebelling against. He was arguing that this was fueling the recession because people were reluctant to take risks in trade because they would remain responsible for the activities of the trade. I can understand that for the debts. You understand that you want people to take risks with capital, but when you're taking risks with harm to other people and harm to land, then the two have to go together. Once, if you separate the responsibility off from the people running the business, it's not just the debts that get separated off, it's everything.
This is like I'm into my historical parallels here, but it's funny, you know, this picture, this demonstration about gentrification in Warwick the other week in Broadmead, when the people arrived there, the first thing the police do, and they tend to do on any demonstration, is to try and find an individual who is responsible for the demonstration. And if you happen to be over 40, fairly straight looking with a mobile like me, then you get approached, of course. Yeah. So they come and say, are you responsible for this demonstration? You go, well, why did you ask me? You know. But there's the parallel, of course, is with like Captain Swing and Ned Lowe. Because the people use a similar tactic to try and, you know, create a fictitious person to represent their movement. And for a long time, the authorities did hunt these people down. You know, Ned Lowe was hunted, famously. So it's kind of a parallel there, you know, the same tactic used by people in sort of popular struggles to try and, you know, to mask the leadership, to mask those people who are actually organising it.
That's one of the implications of hopefully the paper, is that there's five ways that we can look at corporations and challenge them, and typically we only talk about three of these ways. The first way is the Gladstone approach, the laissez-faire capitalism. You allow corporations to be real people and just let them do whatever, and that this is to the common good. The second approach is the state socialist approach, sometimes called the state capitalist approach, the idea that all corporate activity will be nationalised and the state will run all business activity. And this is an area which certainly through the 60s and 70s the left concentrated on, as a response to corporate activity. We've seen through places like Vietnam and East Germany and Russia that this gave bureaucrats huge amounts of power over people's lives and generally led to problems of its own. The third way of viewing corporations has really been the only response that you hear debated nowadays as how we deal with corporations. This is a liberal response, and this accepts that corporations are real people and asks them to behave as responsible people. And we hear this time and time again about corporate responsibility and corporate ethics, that these corporations live in our community and we must ask them to try and abide by certain rules. And there's the Companies Act has, when it was redone in I think it was 2001, has a section in it which says that a corporation has to take into account its employees and its environmental responsibilities. But you have to bear in mind that the only person who can challenge a corporation for not taking into account its employees and environmental responsibilities is the director of the company itself. It's an entirely pointless section, because the only people who aren't going to be doing it are the only people who can enforce it. And huge amounts of money, there's NGOs that exist purely to encourage corporations to behave as more responsible citizens. The fourth and fifth ways we don't hear discussed at all. The fourth way is a way that came out of the States. Programme of Corporations, Law and Democracy in the States. And their idea was this. We talk about the state and individuals, and that the state is responsible for human rights, individuals have the benefit of human rights. Corporations are not people, they're creations of the state. They're not created by birth, they're created by the state. And we should simply stop seeing corporations as people and start seeing them as things which the state creates for the benefit of society. And so this would change overnight the whole relationship with corporations, because we could then, corporations would be subject to human rights law, and challenges to their actions could be made under human rights law, and they themselves wouldn't be able to claim the protection of human rights law. They wouldn't be able to compete with us for our rights, but instead they would be subject to our rights. They wouldn't be able to claim we are entitled to free use of our property, because they wouldn't have that right. They'd be in the same position as a governmental body. We should have to take into account the rights of individuals. And we do not hear this discussed at all, this approach to corporations of stopping them being seen as people. The fifth approach, which again we don't hear at all, is simply the abolition of the corporate form. That we revert to a time that if you're going to carry out business, you must be responsible for your actions. That you can't create imaginary friends and say they are the ones carrying out these activities and you can't come after me for them. Now, it will be impossible to do this on the scale that's happening today. It would be impossible to have a multinational corporation without the corporate form, because that many individuals simply couldn't cope on that level. Capitalism would have to change its nature. It would have to become small scale, because there's only so many individuals that can cooperate together to run a business, especially if they're going to be responsible for the debts and responsible for the harm caused by the corporate activity. And again, we just don't hear it debated. All debate on the corporation is forced down this line of corporate responsibility and corporate ethics. And the whole failure of that approach is it starts from the premise that they are real people and they do have entitled to rights and that we should treat them as people. But you just can't restrain them in the way that you would restrain a noisy neighbour or someone who's threatening you in the streets. The comparison is a void one. But it's the only one we hear debated, and the government finances NGOs to spend money on this. Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth have been diverted down this for decades. I tried to talk to them about this 10, 12 years ago, saying you shouldn't be involved in this activity because it gives credibility to the idea that they are people and they have rights. But they couldn't get past this understanding. They couldn't get past that. The New Economics Foundation is another one that simply will not recognise the bankruptcy of this method of discourse with corporations. But then all these bodies are receiving government grants to take part in corporate responsibility, and corporations are paying people like Friends of the Earth to do audits on them and show what nice corporations they are. So it's co-opted them into a system which simply doesn't deal with the underlying problem.
About workers' control?
Well, workers' control will be the no corporate situation.
So the workers controlling the corporation?
Well, with it still having the corporate form.
Employees being in
charge. Yeah, a bit like John Lewis. Well, again, you would have huge shareholders' meetings with thousands of workers, but you would still have the issue that those workers would not be responsible for the actions of the corporation. And those workers would still, you know, their lawyers would advise them to set up subsidiary corporations to carry out the risky activities. And if you have no responsibility, then you're going to take risks that a person with responsibility just cannot take. I mean, would you really transfer nuclear fuel through the city centre of towns on the railways if you were responsible for the outcome? You just wouldn't do it. You can only undertake that sort of ridiculously risky activity. Would you be drunk at the helm of a ship with thousands of tons of oil on board if the people whose oil it was are going to be personally responsible for the activities? Are you going to allow someone with an alcoholism record to captain that ship? Well, if it's just an insurance risk and a limited risk because it's a shell company running it, and, you know, this captain's quite cheap and you don't want to go to the expense to get another one, then these are risks you can take. So, yes, you would hope that if workers are running the corporation, they'd run it for the public good. But to some extent, that's one of the failures of state capitalism. The whole basis of the idea of this Leninist system, that if it's the workers' state running the corporations, then of course it's going to act in the public interest. But it doesn't. Because people understand their own issues and their own problems, they don't necessarily understand other people. They don't know what else they're trampling upon. And you can't make a workers-owned corporation that's drilling oil in the Nigerian Delta respond in any other way as you can do to British Petroleum through political pressure. You can't restrain the corporation. And I can understand where you're coming from, but I would much prefer a situation where you just abolished the corporate form and said and abolished the idea of having these mammoth corporations with huge hierarchies of subsidiary corporations, and said, no, let's get back to small groups of people carrying out business, cooperating with each other, trading with each other, But this idea of the, you know, what we have now, where, you know, 50 or 100 corporations owning more wealth than everyone else and having no responsibility,
it's just something that we've just got to get away from.
Are there any sort of organisations, you know, question groups, or whatever, at all talking about this? Because it sounds like just really, really an important thing. Is there anyone talking about
it? In America, it has always been a much more debated issue, because in America, there's this idea that the people are sovereign. There's no concept of king. So the people are sovereign. And their approach to this is that corporations have become sovereign through stealing the identity of people. And again, Steve was talking about this, the idea of being radical, but being so in a very patriotic way. They can be radical, but in a way that people see it as patriotic. They say, we are the people, and the corporations have stolen our nation by pretending to be the people and carrying out activities in our name. And I think there's an equivalent pamphlet to mine in the States, which is called Not In My Name, where they're saying that, you know, the people, these are not the sovereign people of the United States doing it. So as well as the Program on Corporations, Law and Democracy, there's a whole load of other bodies, particularly on the West Coast, who are interested in this. In this country, there is nothing. When I was involved in this it was late 80s, early 90s, very early 90s, I would go from body to body. I spoke to Greenpeace, spoke to Friends of the Earth, spoke to the New Economics Foundation. I spoke to the body that had been created, it was Tradecraft and other people, to debate the New Companies Act. The idea was the government wanted someone from this sector to come and debate the New Companies Act. And I tried to talk to them, not about the abolition of corporations, but the idea that corporations stopped being seen as people, and the idea that we campaigned for corporations to be made subject to human rights law. They called me an extremist. They just did not want to know. Either they didn't understand, or they said I was a nutter. New Economics Foundation called me a nutter. They said, this is mad, this is extremism. At the Centre for Corporate Accountability, again, they have grants. I know the guys who run them, and they're good friends of mine. But they said, look, you know, we're involved in this idea of criminal responsibility of corporations. You know, how can you lock up someone that doesn't have a body? How can you do this? And again, they said, oh, you're just too extreme for us. No one wanted to debate it. There was a beginning to be a nexus of interest in it in about 1991. Around Corporate Watch, which was then very influential. The Gaia Foundation had some people who were sort of interested in it. And also there was the Rhodes campaigns, there was the GM campaigns. There was various people who were starting to get interested. People were asking me actually to publish in their magazines. I published one in Red Pepper magazine about how corporations, because the Human Rights Act was about to come in, and how corporations were going to use this for their own benefits. People from Liberty were sending me hate mail. Say, how dare I diss the Human Rights Act when they'd fought so long to get it into British law by arguing that this is something that corporations would use. But it was sort of beginning to happen, but then, three things happened, two from, you know, an international perspective, that 9/11 and then the Gulf War destroyed this alliance of anti-corporate activity, because 90% of the people who were interested in it stopped being interested in it and started being interested in anti-war campaigns. And anti-terrorism issues and civil and political rights then became more important again, and campaigns about social, economic and cultural rights stopped being important. And from my own perspective, I had two children and I lost all time and energy. A similar story existed in the late 80s and 90s. There was a group that I worked with a lot called the Centre for Economic and Social Rights. And they were based on the idea, I talked a bit about this when Peter Linebaugh was here last time, that in 1956 there were two international human rights conventions, the Civil and Political Rights Convention, which is what also became the European Convention of Human Rights, is now the Human Rights Act, and the Economic, Social and Cultural Rights Convention, which deals with things like economic rights and rights to medicine, rights to resources, which has been completely ignored. It is, essentially, yeah, it is. And it was the communist states that insisted it was ratified. The Western states insisted it be two separate conventions rather than one, to be civil and political in one, social, economic and cultural in the other, and it's been entirely ignored. And if you you would try and they would try and talk to this with human rights people, and they'd say, no, these rights are aspirational, we're not interested in them, they're too complex, we're not interested in them. And they were in they were working a lot, particularly in the West Bank and Gaza in Palestine, and they were saying that this transfer from, because at the time there was the Oslo Convention, the idea that the land would be transferred from Israeli control to Palestinian control, they were saying this is useless, because the social, economic and cultural rights of the Palestinians who live in these lands is being entirely ignored. You're creating a nation in which people cannot earn a living. They've got no access to land, they've got no access to anything, they're entirely dependent on aid at the moment, and you're simply passing control from a democratic state which is occupying their nation illegally to a country, to a state which will occupy their nation legally but will be fascistic. And they were forced out of Gaza, principally by organisations like Amnesty, who were so tied into this idea of Oslo and progress on civil and political rights and self-determination, that they were just not interested in economic rights at all. So in this country, it's impossible. Another example, I went along to the Haldane Society of Socialist Lawyers, and this is when I started off as being a lawyer, and they were getting all the students involved, and they said, we've got all these different bodies that look at different things, we've got something that looks at crime, we've got something that looks at immigration, we've got something that looks at family. And I said to them, how about, you know, looking at corporations and corporate activity? And again, I just got this blank stare at them. And eventually one of them said, well, if you join our crime group, I think they might be doing something on corporate fraud, but it's not really what they're into. And again, there's just a complete lack of engagement at all. Everything is between individuals and the state. And we've not recognised that much of the conflict in this country is between real individuals and fictional individuals. The state is passive in this and stands back from it all and pretty much allows the fictional individuals to do what they like. And again, as fictional individuals with human rights, they have the right to fund political party. They have the right to lobby politicians. And they have our human rights to participation. They can't vote, but they don't really need to, because they own the main political parties. No political party now can afford to campaign without corporate money, because who can afford the adverts and the TV time and the radio time and the buses and the hoardings and the publicity material? You can't do this without corporate money. You can't participate. Politics has become redundant. On a state level, it is all about the conflict between real people and fictional people, and it's not even a national issue anymore. National boundaries are no interest to these people, because without a physical body they're not restrained by immigration law, and they can set up in any country and they can move to any country. They don't have the physical restraints we can, and the Thai government can say, if you want to operate in our country, or the Indian government can say, you want to operate in our company, you can't, it's got to be Indian companies. They say, okay, we'll set up an Indian company. BP India, BP Mumbai, there you go, it's an Indian company, let's go. You know, they can create themselves as fictional people wherever they like in the world. But, it is the imaginary friends who you can blame.
Who are the real people who are running these corporations anyway?
Yeah.
That they run the states. Aren't they the hierarchy that are the elites that have invested that money in from the beginning of these things?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, Dave Gorman just wrote a book on this, the idea about the concept of the man, that somewhere there is the man who is running all these corporations, and he goes off in pursuit of the man. But he, as he says, that you go up these chains and people who you think are the man, in fact, say that they are owned by the man and don't have any power in this situation. That the man is above and beyond them somewhere. And the structures themselves create... these people become almost like cells or neurons in this fictional body, where you have... particularly the oil companies, they are made up of thousands and thousands of corporations, but these corporations are, to some extent, independent. When I talked about this oil trade, where BP at an oil well will sell its oil to another BP company, which will then transport it across the sea. It will sell it to another BP company, which is an oil trading company, which will sell it on to a BP oil refinery run by another company, which will use the oil. All these corporations are genuinely independent and separate. And so none of the individuals running any of these companies have any real power in the structure. They are just like neurons in a system passing it around, and the capital just has a life of its own. Because the capital is there to make as much money as it can, and individual people will make decisions about what that capital will do. But there becomes almost this relative autonomy of the corporation, where it acts almost under its own will, because it's the thousands of people within the structure making individual decisions all over the place, which together cause this overall body to walk and talk and act. So there is no man with a white cat planning what BP will do next.
No, there's an elite. There's a leader that's going
to be there. Yeah, but they're just chief executives that often move from company to company. They'll call themselves just salary men doing a job. If they say, I don't like this, I don't want my corporation to do this anymore, shareholders will vote them out and someone else will come in. And I think we're wasting our time talking to these people. And all they're interested in is getting Friends of the Earth to do an audit and say they're actually not that bad after all. But that's only for their own, personal feelings about what nice people they are. And it also helps them, when they're funding the Labour Party, it helps them say, well, look, here's all our money. By the way, here's our Friends of the Earth audit. And can we influence your policies, please? The first person that Tony Blair appointed when Labour were elected in 97? The first appointment he made, first day he was appointed, was Lord Brown, the chairman of BP. That was the first appointment he made. I always presumed that when Labour Party came to power, the first thing it would do was take on the ownership of the tabloid press. But no, the first thing he did was appointed Britain's most powerful corporate oligarch as a non-elected member of his cabinet. Just unbelievable. Unbelievable. The People's Party.
You talk about what I coming here have viewed as a corporation, say BP or Coca-Cola or whoever. And I've come in thinking that's a corporation, a multinational corporation.
Yeah.
You're saying that, in effect, it's a massive cells of corporation.
Yeah, it's 8,000 corporate cells operating as one body.
What is your definition of, say, BP? We as the ordinary people see it as a company.
Yeah.
Well, you're saying it most definitely isn't.
No, it's no single company.
What's your definition of this entity?
Well, you've got a sliding scale all the way through from the... I've got a friend of mine who's a comedian. He exists as a single director company, so that when he appears on stage, you pay his company, and he performs. He is the employee of his company. He tells his jokes, and then the check goes to his company, and he gets a dividend at the end of the year. He is a corporation. He's using it for tax and expenses reasons. That is a corporation. BP at the other end. But there's a whole sliding scale. There's no. It doesn't go up in steps.
The ones that are, these massive ones.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, if you have a single fungal spore and then you have a huge clump of mushrooms, when does it stop becoming a mushroom, or when does it become something else? It's just... it's all.
But that is a corporation. Is a fiction. You're saying.
Well, the whole thing is based on the fiction that it is a person. That's the central fiction, that they are real people, with real Well, it's a fictional person with fictional responsibilities. So the second, the whole point of this guy becoming his corporation is that he can, if for whatever reason, he hires his car. He buys a car through the corporation on hire purchase. If for whatever reason he's injured and he can't go to gigs and he can't keep up on the payments of his car, they can't come after him. They can only go after his corporation. His corporation goes bankrupt. He's just a shareholder. He survives. He can't touch him. All he loses is his shares, which cost nothing anyway. It is the same philosophy at that most basic, simple level. All the way through to your BP and your Shells. It's just a matter of scale, and it's just a matter of the use of subsidiaries, particularly the use of a separate subsidiary to carry out each separate risky activity, and this idea of transfer of risky activities and transfer of past actions, responsibility for past actions, that you run the company this year, then we will leave you dormant, and you will just basically sit in a dusty room for eternity, doing nothing but remaining responsible for what we did in the past, and it will pass on to another company. So, again, it's just a bigger scale of it. And it's true, it was never envisaged that this would happen. The whole idea of subsidiarisation takes it to a completely other level. But, you know, subsidiarisation exists. You know, even the guy with two newspaper shops will almost certainly have two separate companies and a parent company, so that if one shop, for whatever reason, gets into horrible trouble and goes bust, it doesn't affect the other. So someone says, well, okay, you know, that's burned down, but you owe us money. We want the assets of your other shop. You can go, no, you can't. It's a separate corporation. So even at that level, that they're using subsidiary corporations to protect themselves. And it just builds up and up and up. And much of this corporate activity, you've got to remember, happens not necessarily through planning, but through mergers and acquisitions, where whole huge bodies of companies are merged into other existing companies. This is particularly interesting when working on the asbestos litigation. You're dealing with someone who worked 50 years ago for a lagging company, and he lagged asbestos, and you're trying to find out what happened to them. And what you'll find is that that company was bought up by another one, and bought up by another one, and bought up by another one. And over the years, you get all this rolling up, and you find that these larger, they tended to become, you know, heating engineering companies. Planned maintenance is one, which is, I'm not sure if you've heard of it. And in planned maintenance, within the corporate body, are hundreds and hundreds of zombie corporations, which still have their past names. Corporations that existed decades ago and did things in the past, but sold on their assets and their contracts to planned maintenance, or wherever it was in the structure, but remained to hold the responsibility for the past activity.
When you sell on the assets, where does the money go? You must have paid for it. Doesn't the original company have the money?
Well, often they're sold on, it's done by a loan. Often there's no real transfer of money. We will buy your assets. Let's say, you know, you've got £100,000 worth of assets. We will agree to pay you £100,000. You give us the assets, okay? We will then promise to pay you that £100,000 in the future, but we will then sell on the assets to someone else who buys those assets with a loan from a second company, and they haven't actually paid us either. And then it goes sideways to the company that then carries on the business. You know, lawyers are paid a lot of money to think up these things. So when, you know, you say, but surely you had the £100,000. What happened to the £100,000? Well, we never actually got it. We still owed it. Okay, well, we'll go after the person who owes you the money. Ah, well, they don't actually have anything either. They're a company set up solely for the idea of purchasing these assets and passing them on. They're sort of the buffer companies. You know, and there's huge amounts of companies that are just created for these purposes. And then it'll go through some company in Switzerland, so you can't find out what they're doing or where they are. And there's use of offshore registers is a big thing. There's lots and lots of developing countries that use their company's register as a way of earning money. Turks and Caicos do this a lot. Bermuda does this a lot. A lot of these places are places where you can found corporations in registers where you're not allowed to find out who the shareholders are. England has an open register. Britain has an open corporate register. You can find out the name and address of every single shareholder of every company registered in this country. But you'll find out that most of the big corporate ones, are the shares are owned by either trusts in Switzerland, which are secrets, or corporations that exist in these registers, which are secrets. So you can't find out who then owns the company above. So there's all sorts of techniques to prevent you chasing down the line. What we used to do is we just used to go after the PLC at the top and said, well, we're going to challenge it. Someone, somewhere down this line must own it, and we would challenge them, and they'd find an insurer and pay us out. But there was no legal validity to what we were doing. We were just, you know, just trying to embarrass them. And we were only after, you know, 20, 30 grand for some widow or something. You know, we weren't after big money. But even that sort of approach ended up with the big companies, the Turner & Newell and the Capes, doing this system and then making the company at the bottom assetless so it just couldn't be pursued anymore. And so those companies are no longer paying out asbestos compensation in this country. Same happened in the state with John Mansville, which is the big asbestos producer over there. And in fact, it was that technique that was adopted in England, of just consciously leaving behind the shell, bearing the responsibility.
Brad?